From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I do remember the story of President Truman, who was asked, how did you feel after deciding to launch the nuclear bombs, Nagasaki and Hiroshima, causing at the end the fatalities of 200,000 casualties? And he said, when I heard from my officers that the alternative is a long war with Japan, with potential fatalities of a couple of millions, I saw that it is a moral decision.
That was Israel's defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon, responding to a question from a member of the audience who asked if Israel was at a strategic disadvantage vis-a-vis Iran.
We are not there yet, but that's what I'm talking about, certain steps in cases in which we feel like we don't have the answer by surgical operations or something like that.
That response from Israel's defense minister at a press conference in May was circulating the social media this week as a steady stream of Democrats announced they would vote against President Obama's implementation of the international agreement reached between the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the European Union, and the U.S. with Iran. The latest defections here in New York include Senator Chuck Schumer and Representatives Elliot Engel, Nita Lowey, and Steve Israel. The Israeli defense minister's comments were out of step with the sentiments expressed Thursday by the UN's Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Speaking on the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, he called for a world free of nuclear weapons as survivors gathered in Japan at the Peace Memorial Park in Hiroshima to honor the more than 100,000 people killed by the world's first atomic strike. This past week saw a deal struck between the UN and its NATO ally Turkey to allow U.S. warplanes to conduct operations from Turkish bases. Dan Williams reports.
U.S. officials say in perhaps 2 to 3 weeks, air campaigns against ISIL will intensify. For a year now, American fighter jets have taken off from the Persian Gulf, flown nearly 2,000 kilometers, dropped their bombs on ISIL targets, and then had to fly 2,000 kilometers back to their bases. Now, Turkey has allowed the U.S. to use its bases, particularly the Incirlik base, which is just 300 kilometers from the closest ISIL targets. It's a significant difference. And officials say these bases should be fully up and running with U.S. fighter jets and other countries' fighter jets involved in just a couple of weeks. Right now, supplies are being brought in. Aircraft, weapons, communication systems, and a major ramping up is underway. Reports suggest this will effectively create a no-fly zone.
There has been international concern about statements made by Washington indicating its intent to use air cover to defend the so-called moderate rebels it has recruited, trained, armed, and placed into Syria. However, a glimmer of hope for peace in Syria, in the midst of widespread discontent over that recent U.S. escalation, with a mechanism to determine who is using chemical weapons in the country, unanimously adopted by the U.N. Security Council Friday. A fact-finding mission of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said last December that chlorine gas had most likely been used as a weapon of war in the ongoing conflict in that country. Daniel Dickinson reports.
The Syrian conflict is now in its fifth year. There have been reports of the indiscriminate use of chemical weapons by both sides. The 15 Security Council members voted to establish a joint mechanism of the UN and OPCW for 1 year initially, which will be tasked with identifying who is responsible for using those weapons. It's expected that the mechanism will be set up within the next 3 weeks. US Ambassador Samantha Power said the chemical attacks had continued despite the Council's previous efforts to stop them.
Today's resolution has been adopted with the Council's unanimous support. This sends a clear and powerful message to all those involved in chemical weapons attacks in Syria. The Joint Investigative Mechanism will identify you if you gas people. it bears repeating as well that we need to bring the same unity that we have shown today to urgently find a political solution to the Syrian crisis.
Over 250,000 people have been killed in Syria since the start of the civil war in March 2011. An estimated 9 million Syrians have fled the country. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, spoke after Ambassador Power.
I thank you, Madam President. The effective implementation of the decisions of the Security Council and its Resolution 2118 on the destruction of Syria's chemical arsenal, adopted on the initiative of Russia and the United States of America, is one of the most significant successes of the Council, reaffirming the opportunity for productive joint work on the most urgent problems of our times. Against this backdrop, the Council could not overlook the announcements about alleged use in Syria of toxic chemicals as chemical weapons. In the spring of last year, under the Organization of the Prohibition for Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, the fact-finding mission began its work and, with a great deal of certainty, identified the use of chlorine as a weapon in several populated areas of Syria. The Russian Federation decisively condemns such acts. We believe that they are unacceptable and run counter to the Chemical Weapons Convention. At the same time, the question of who used chlorine is still unanswered, partly because the existing mechanisms of the UN and OPCW do not have a mandate to identify those participating in such acts. Moreover, we became witnesses of the many politicized statements in this regard, which were clearly meant to be propaganda. It was necessary to eliminate this gap, which was done with the adoption of today's resolution, creating the preconditions for the launching of a joint mission of the UN and the OPCW, the Joint Investigative Mechanism, the JIM. We believe that today's decision is, first of all, preventive, and it lays the foundations for the future to do away with the future use of toxic chemicals as weapons in Syria. We believe that the JIM will work impartially, objectively, and professionally. The guarantee of this should be the Secretary General's of the UN and the OPCW's General Director's successful experience that they've had during the destruction of the chemical arsenal in Syria, as well as the successful cooperation of these two international organizations in the fact-finding mission. We believe that this principle should guide the further work of the JIM. Taking into account the complex political and military situation in Syria, we believe it is extremely important that the JIM can correctly develop relationships within the country and develop a mechanism in the field. Otherwise, that wouldn't be possible. In Damascus, as earlier, and this has been reaffirmed in documents of OPCW and the UN, there will be assistance to the JIM and the mission in establishing facts of who used chlorine in the chemical weapons. Madam President, in conclusion, I would like to emphasize that any efforts in the Syrian area must be in line with the logic of assisting a search for a political solution to the conflict and should not lead to the further antagonization of the parties. And this remains a priority in combating terrorism and the political solution of the crisis in Syria. Thank you, Madam President.
Ambassador Churkin's comments were followed by some words from China's permanent representative, Liu Zhiyi.
Madam President, China welcomes the Council's unanimous adoption of Resolution 2235. China's position on chemical weapons is clear and consistent. We resolutely oppose use of chemical weapons by anyone under any circumstances. We express our concern on the incident of use of chlorine gas as a weapon within Syria as verified by OPCW. We support objective, just, and professional investigation on this incident and bring perpetrators to justice when there is hard evidence. During this process, the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Syria should be respected so as to play its role by the United Nations and the OPCW. China expects that the Secretary General will submit soon to the Council his report on the establishment of a joint investigative mechanism as called for in Resolution 2235. A political settlement is the only way out to resolve the Syrian issue. At present, Special Envoy de Mistura is making unrelenting effort to advance a political settlement of the Syrian issue. The international community, especially the Security Council, should stay the course and not waver in the general direction of a political settlement and unanimously support the UN in the leadership role it has played in the political settlement and support Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Special Envoy de Mistura in their good offices. China hopes that Resolution 2235, as has been unanimously adopted by the Council, will be conducive to forging a consensus of the Council on the Syrian issue and give new impetus to a comprehensive, enduring, and appropriate settlement of the Syrian issue through political means at an early date. China would like to continue to play its positive and constructive role to this end. Thank you, Madam President.
Meanwhile, talks to help find a resolution to the conflict in Libya, now in its fifth year, will start again at the UN in Geneva, according to a statement from officials there Friday. Libya has been at war since the U.S.-led NATO bombing of that country began in February 2011. Daniel Johnson has more.
Details are still sketchy about who's taking part in discussions on a peace agreement in Libya, or even what format they might take, according to the UN. That will become clearer once they arrive at the UN in Geneva on Monday. It's believed, however, that around 30 invitees will take part in the political dialogue, which is due to end on Wednesday. United Nations spokesperson Ahmed Fawzi said he did not know why negotiator Bernardino Leon believed that now was the right time to hold new discussions in the Swiss city.
I don't know why he decided that the time was ripe, but clearly he thinks it is for a new round of the Libyan political dialogue to take place in Geneva. He wouldn't have announced this unless he thought there was sufficient common ground to bring the parties here, all the way from there to Geneva.
But Fawzi also told reporters that the new round of talks did not mean that there's been any great revelation between the rival factions. And he repeated UN negotiator Leon's acknowledgement that some of the opposing parties still have reservations about what's been achieved to date. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
And now we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, for an update on news and events throughout the Western Hemisphere south of El Rio Grande.
As usual, there's so much going on, it's difficult to know where to start. But for example, here in the region, events in El Salvador are still very, very uncertain because of the so-called transport strike, which isn't really a strike in the normal sense of the word. And what's happened over the last two or three weeks is that the gangs, the Maras, they're pretty much organized crime at this stage in their development.
Yeah, I had asked you if the mafia was going on strike last week, joking.
Right, yeah. So that they've been trying to intimidate transport owners, and for a while transport owners were intimidated and took their buses, which are essentially El Salvador's principal means of public transport, off the road for a few days. And then the government organized a plan to provide more security to the bus owners and the bus drivers. But in El Salvador's context, perhaps the violence hasn't been so much out of the normal, but I'm looking at it from here in Nicaragua, it just seems absolutely horrific. And over the last two or three, something like 9 bus drivers have been, and I think they've been killed. And there have been shootouts between the police and the gangs, in which gang members have died, police have been killed, and for us here in Nicaragua, it's just an extraordinary situation, and so we look on that with a very great concern, because although there have been isolated incidents in the past of violence against public transport, both in Honduras and Guatemala and in El Salvador, And the Salvadoran government is suggesting that the political opposition, the former governing party, ARENA, which is a very right-wing party with roots in the right-wing death squads of the war of the 1980s, the current FMLN government under President Sanchez Cerén, is suggesting that ARENA are working hand-in-glove with the Maras to destabilise the government, and that may well be true.
Yeah.
So there's that going on in El Salvador, which is incredibly depressing.
Yeah, before we leave that, maybe you could give listeners a little context, explain what the government is in El Salvador and you know, the changes recently from when ARENA had power, and you know, just kind of what the political situation is.
Yeah, in El Salvador, I hope I don't give too ignorant a summary of it. I know a little bit about El Salvador. El Salvador, like the rest of the Central American countries that were at war throughout the 1980s, and they reached a peace process as a peace agreement in the early 1990s. And as happened very, very much here in Nicaragua, what happened in El Salvador was that the right-wing political the right-wing political parties were able to capitalize on people's overwhelming desire for peace. And so they got a strong political majority, and they were in power for however many years it was. I mean, in Nicaragua, the right-wing parties, very loyal to Washington and to U.S. government policy, they were in power for 16, 17 years until January 2007. And then in El Salvador, the right-wing ARENA party, which with, I think its original founder was Roberto Dobison, who was originally known as Blowtorch Bob for his the techniques that he used while he was torturing left-wing guerrillas and alleged sympathizers, and he was the original founder of ARENA, so I think that's where ARENA comes from. It's an extremely right-wing political party. Then in El Salvador, Mauricio Funes won the elections, I think it was back in 2008, that he took power. And Mauricio Funes was a kind of social democrat who struck an alliance with the FMLN party. And the FMLN is the political party that represents the left-wing guerrillas. It's inherited the political legacy of the left-wing guerrillas of the 1980s, so diametrically opposed to ARENA. And when Mauricio Funes became president, there was a constant tension between his social democrat approach and what was a somewhat more radical approach from the mainstream FMLN party. But Mauricio Funes had a very successful period of government between 2008 and 2012. And then in the election for the subsequent presidential period, the FMLN managed to secure a political majority on its own without making that alliance with social democrat elements. And so they took power, and I think they took power in 2013, and I'm shaky on the exact dates, but Salvador Sanchez Cerén, who's the current president, is a veteran guerrilla leader of the FMLN, and he's decided to follow very much the kind of social democrat kinds of policies that were so successful under Mauricio Funes, or in relative terms, of course. And so that's, and ARENA have now been out of power for however many years it is, 7 or 8 years. And they're looking at being out of power for the duration. And so in the same way that the Venezuelan opposition are destabilizing the government of President Nicolas Maduro, and that the right-wing Bolivian opposition have been trying to destabilize Evo Morales, and the opposition in Ecuador are currently trying another wave of destabilization against Rafael Correa.
And Brazil, you have this and Argentina, Brazil, yeah, right.
Yeah, and it's, so it's all part of the right-wing and are trying to take advantage of the current economic downturn in South America and Central America and the Caribbean to mount a political offensive. But I think that they've got their timing wrong. I think they've left it. They're trying to do it too early. And I think that they're going to fail, and that'll enable the. I'm hoping that by getting their timing wrong on their political offensive, it'll lead to another period of progressive political governments in Latin America and the Caribbean, on the whole, not everywhere, and that'll enable those progressive governments to see out the current economic downturn, which we hope is temporary, it might not be, and then they'll continue to be able to develop the progressive policies that have been so successful and so positive for the region over the last 7, 8, 9 years.
Not only that, if you look at the example of Venezuela after the first coup against Hugo Chavez, what it actually enabled was a more radical policy turn on behalf of the government, which announced essentially it was going to try to go directly to socialism from there. And
right.
And so if the conditions are right, and as you describe them, then it may well be that the entire region may see that kind of move enabled and perhaps implemented.
Yeah, and the reason I talk about an economic downturn. I don't know what the perception is of people in the United States, but recently the UN's economic policy body for Latin America and the Caribbean, in English it's called ECLAC, the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean. It's a UN organization. In Spanish it's called CEPAL. And what CEPAL have done recently is produced a report about they do it every year. The economic outlook for Latin America and the Caribbean, and in that outlook, in the summary, they're very clear that the overall in the region, they expect growth to be very meagre, under 1%, and in South America overall, they expect the sub-region of South America's economy to actually contract by about 0.5%. And in Central America, it's somewhat better. They're expecting growth of somewhat over 2%. And in Nicaragua's case, Nicaragua, along with Panama, is likely to see growth of getting on for 5%. Panama, because of its widening of the canal, this massive infrastructure project widening the canal, Panama may well have growth of well over that, maybe 6 or even 7%. So. And there's a very uneven economic pattern throughout the region, but they're expecting the economies of South America to be hardest hit because of the kind of 1-2 punch in economic terms of lower global volumes of trade. The countries of South America are able to sell fewer of their products, and that's combined with a decline in prices. So not only are countries in the region having difficulty selling as much as they used to, but they're getting lower prices for what they do sell, and that's going to cause big problems for the countries in the region, in particular combined with the noises coming out of the Federal Reserve in the United States, that they're going to increase interest rates, because if they increase interest rates, that's going to have knock-on effects on the currencies in South America. So the overall economic outlook in the short term, particularly if the Federal Reserve does, in fact, I don't think they will, but I don't think the U.S. economy is strong enough, but they're talking about raising interest rates.
Right.
So, and let's see what happens. But it's not looking good in economic terms for the region generally, and is of course of great concern to progressive governments in the region because of the effects that may have in electoral terms.
Yeah, you know, on that, I mean, and it's interesting because it's the short term prospects that would impact the elections, and then
the entire project, depending on the outcome of those elections. But long-term, I mean, the problem, quote-unquote, that you have here in particular is that much of the exports, or, you know, an oversized part of the exports from the region are, you know, natural resources and, you know, oil, you know, those kinds of economic goods and, you know, unfinished, in other words. And long-term trend, of course, as those reserves are exhausted, is that those prices will go up. But, you know, there are market forces at work in the short term that have driven them down. And what they've been trying to do in the region is to build the capacity to start offering finished goods, which is going to have another effect, you know, in terms of global economics, but ultimately allow them to weather this kind of storm. And China's investment plans in building infrastructure there, like you're seeing, I guess probably part of the effect in Nicaragua is the preliminary work being done for the canal. You know, that's going to show real growth over the medium and long term.
Yeah, and not just for Nicaragua, but for the region, for the Central American region. So far, the economic effects of the canal investment have been very minor. And the interesting thing about Nicaragua is that without the soon to develop investments in the canal and its various sub projects, and Daniel Ortega's government has been able to do is to combine a successful campaign to attract investment into Nicaragua with domestic measures to strengthen the overwhelmingly agricultural economy and democratize the economy so that it brings more people into active economic productive activities through all kinds of schemes to do with microcredit and so forth. Promoting cooperatives and that kind of thing that have in the prior period of the rightly neoliberal governments, large sections of the Nicaraguan population were excluded from economic activity because they just had no access to credit. And what the economic policies of the Nicaraguan government under Daniel Ortega have done is completely transform the access to credit and access to financial resources in general for the for large numbers of people who were previously excluded from the economy, and it's that combination of attracting investment and promoting the domestic economy that has enabled Nicaragua to buck the trend in terms of the region, in terms of its low economic growth. And the important thing, of course, in Nicaragua is that, and you can have growth, but that doesn't necessarily benefit people at the bottom of the heap. And the important thing about Nicaragua as well, apart from the democratization of its economy, in terms of bringing more people into active economic productive activity, has been its redistributive effects. And it's redistributive policies and guaranteeing people access to health services and education that before they'd have had to pay for, and now they don't. And so that's, you know, that redistributive effect in all kinds of ways, not just health and education, but lots of things.
Yeah, they now have the money to buy.
Had a tremendous positive effect on Nicaragua's growth.
Right, of course, because I don't have to spend all my money on health care and education. Now I can go buy stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And as well as saying that fundamental things like systematically increasing the minimum wage every year. In fact, it's twice a year. And the current framework is a tripartite framework in relation to the minimum wage here that is composed of a government negotiating team from the Ministry of Labor, trade union labor organizations, and the business sector. They all sit down together and work out, you know, what the minimum wage is likely to be or should be over the next 12-month period, and they schedule a twice-yearly increase.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.